Welcome to the B-side. Thank you for joining us once again. We're back showing some consistency here, but thank you for tuning in as always. Please, as we say every podcast, send us your questions, things that come up in your reading, or questions you wonder about Christianity and the Bible, and how to maybe make those things apply in your life. Send it to bside@tachurch.ca. I am Tyler, of course. You should know that. Joined, as always, by Pastor Steve. And we're going to get into some more questions today. We're getting a good section of questions. This is helpful, right? So the question came up a couple weeks ago in one of your recent sermons on the Ten Commandments. You kind of unpacked a little bit of Exodus 20, verse 4, the second commandment. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I am the Lord your God, am a jealous God. And then it carries on to the verse that we talked about last time, actually. But it got one of our listeners thinking that Sunday, and send in this question is, speaking of the image of God and worshiping it, what do we then do with the cross? It's hung in our sanctuary and often could become an object of worship or a visual kind of worship stimulator, if you want to use that term. So in the sense of, how do we kind of handle this passage where God is saying, don't make and worship images, but then in most evangelical churches, a cross, a crucifix is hung or on display in prominent places in the worship space.
And that's nothing compared to if you go to a high church.
Right.
Go visit a cathedral in Europe, old beautiful buildings, and you see images, you see paintings on the walls, you see stained glass, you see crosses, you see all kinds, right? Like, there's going to be like a number of different views on how this works out. So one of the great movements in church history, which gets painted with a bad brush, that's not how the metaphor goes. Anyway, broad brush, is the Puritans. And often we view them as sort of like these angry group, but they're these great theological era of church that people from the Church of England who really wanted to honor God rightly, and they had great theology and just a heart of devotion for God and great joy. But one of the things was their simplicity, is they really valued simplicity. And so they built buildings that were plain and empty, no decoration, nothing on the wall. And the motive was this commandment, that they didn't, to put up anything in their worship would be wrong, because it's to create an image. And so in contrast to the Catholicism and high church Anglicanism of the era, images, crucifixes, paintings, elaborate buildings, all this sort of stuff, they viewed that as borderline idolatry, and it would be better to have simple, plain, nothing, just God. It's just us worshiping God, nothing interfering with God and His Word, and our worship of Him. So that's one perspective.
Right.
And I get what you're doing there. I think there's good value. So in this, I think scholars would say there's a couple different things that are forbidden in the second commandment. One is creating idols. So taking a living thing.
Right.
Maybe it's a crocodile or a... Egyptian god, right? Frogs are an Egyptian god too. They have these frog head things that, these aren't random.
Yeah. I thought it was. I'm sorry.
If you want random, a zebra.
Yeah.
I don't know of any zebra gods.
Partial to giraffes.
Yeah. Giraffe gods. But the calf that they make, which is probably an Egyptian god that they're imitating. So you take an animal and create an idol image of it and worship it. And so that's the one thing. You're worshiping a false god. The other thing that's forbidden here is worshiping the right God in the wrong way. In fact, it's actually a little bit unclear. It's open for interpretation a little bit. In Exodus 32 and the golden calf incident, are they worshiping Yahweh or not? Are they worshiping a different god, or are they creating an image of Yahweh? And they're trying to give this image, and they're worshiping the right god in the wrong way. Both of them are idolatry.
Right.
And God forbids them both in this commandment. So, clearly in our churches, we're not worshiping the wrong god. If you have an image of God or crucifix, maybe it's a picture of what God is like, you drew a painting of God or a picture of Jesus you put up on the screen. We're worshiping the right God, but are we worshiping him the wrong way? And that's where the debate lies. So there would be some who would say, any time you create an image of God, it's wrong. In fact, a guy I really admire, quoted last week, quote often, J.I. Packer.
Yeah.
In Knowing God, in this chapter on the called The One True God, he talks about it. And he kind of takes that Puritan approach, because he was the last great Puritan and a great Puritan scholar, actually. He's one of the most well-known. That's what the thing he's most famous for. We know him for as a popular writer, but in scholarship, he's one of the greatest Puritan scholars of our era. And that's widely shaped how he lived, and his kind of ministry in some ways was taking the Puritan principles and applying them to our lives. But his approach, the more Puritan approach, is that any time you create an image of God, it's problematic and perhaps sinful. So he would struggle with, for instance, an actor playing Jesus in a film. Any picture of God.
So anybody who has a little blonde hair, blue-eyed, bearded painting
of Jesus. You paint a picture of Jesus. Like, he even brings up in that chapter, what about Sunday school images? You're teaching Sunday school and you have a picture of Jesus feeding the 5,000.
The kids are coloring,
that type of thing. Is that right or wrong? And he actually says, he doesn't say it's immoral and wrong, but he says, I'd be pretty cautious here. In fact, to me, it's not worth it. It's not worth the risk. So he would have us, in our Sunday school, you know, the Jesus flanograph out, Jesus film out, you know, a picture of Jesus on the cross, Rembrandt painting out.
The Passion of the Christ.
Passion of the Christ out, all that stuff. Because, and here's the thing, he says, is no matter how hard you try to make it accurate, truthful, and correct, even in saying true things about God, in your picture, in your image, in your stained glass, in your acting out, if it's a play, no matter how many true things you say, you will limit God in some way by not saying everything, or by, you know, in doing your best, every image will be flawed, and therefore you will misrepresent something. You will diminish his glory, and you will portray an inaccuracy. So even if you want to portray the sovereignty, might, and bigness of God with a painting or some sort of thing, even though you say true things about him, you will fail to depict the humility and small and gentleness and imminence of God. So he says, no matter what you do, no representation will be fully accurate, because everything that you do will somehow be inaccurate, and therefore it's wrong. So there's an approach that would say, never do anything like that.
Right.
Now, there's another approach which is kind of built off that, but would say, never use an image in worship. So Packer's saying, and the Puritan way would say, never use it for anything.
Right.
Teaching Sunday school, doing evangelism, showing the Jesus film to help illiterate people hear the gospel is wrong, or shouldn't be done. This second approach is saying, you don't use images to motivate worship. And I think that's better, because that's the context of the second commandment is... Right. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord, am a jealous God. It's all about idolatry for worship. So it's not about images, although I think we should be careful with creating images of God and of Christ. But the problem is using them for worship. So in this view, you know, a painting of Jesus is one thing, a Passion of the Christ, a movie for the sake of art and evangelism, teaching your kids Sunday school, a picture of Jesus is one thing. But putting up a picture of Jesus to motivate our worship, like putting it on the screen, to elicit our worship, would be wrong.
Right.
Because now the image is leading us into worship, and that would be breaking this commandment.
So then
that's where we get to, like, the cross.
Yeah.
Which is the beginning of the cross. Should we have the cross? Now, this is where some people would go, okay, the cross, the empty cross is one thing, the crucifix... The Catholic cross with Jesus on it is, some would say that is imaging and idolatrous versus the empty cross. We're not portraying God. We're just reminded, we have a visual reminder of what Christ did for us by having a cross.
But when as soon as you put Jesus on it, well, I mean, it says so you're saying a lot of things. I mean, there's a to me, Ego, there's a pretty clear distinction in having an empty cross. We'll talk about that on Easter, and a cross with Jesus still on it, right?
Yeah.
Like
that,
those are two different things. But yeah, like I think it's interesting because I can think back in my own life of when we were in Bible college. One of the things that often helped me focus when we were worshiping was in the chapel where we met. There was up high in the ceiling, there was a cross up high, and that's often where I'd fix my glance when we were worshiping. And now, it's got me wondering, going like, okay, I wasn't worshiping the cross; I was worshiping the God of the cross. But not that it could be. We don't want to make the cross the object of our worship. We want the cross to motivate the reminder of the cross to motivate our worship.
Now, so that being said, the other point to be made is in both, particularly in the Old Testament, there are symbols and physical things that remind them of their worship.
Well,
you think about the tabernacle, right?
Yeah.
Right? And the things that are in the tabernacle.
Yeah.
And the things that are around the tabernacle.
Very detailed.
And there's things like there's carvings of, you know, trees that remind them of the Garden of Eden. And there's, you know, and the further you go in, there's more things. Not everyone gets to see those. They don't all get to go in. But there's lots of objects that are there, not as representations of God, but as reminders of what God had done and of the significance of this and artistic resemblance, you know, reminding and teaching. So nothing in the tabernacle is actually making an image of God himself, but there are lots of objects that remind them. So they've got the bread, they've got the candlestick, they've got the carvings and painting or pictures of coconut tree or acacia trees and things like that. So all those things are there to remind them. So I actually think even in the Old Testament that's okay. So I think that's where I'd put the category of the cross. And you also think of like the Lord's Supper as physical reminders that aren't worshipped but are there to remind us of God's character, goodness, his redemptive acts in history that lead us to worship. So, I mean, there's some distinctions to be made. I think that there are ways that we create images of God that would be wrong, and I'd be really cautious of. I think that portraying Jesus for the sake of evangelism and teaching is very different than portraying Jesus for an act of worship. I see a distinction there. I think that there are certain ways that we could image God that would be wrong. You know, for instance, a question. I mean, we didn't plan to talk about this, but so Morgan Freeman plays God. In
Bruce Almighty?
Bruce Almighty.
And the other one, too. Evan Almighty or something?
His portrayal of God wasn't totally heretical.
No.
Like, the way he did it, he tried to show that, you know, the way he acts seems godly in some sense. But in portraying him one way, no matter how true and accurate you try to be, you're limiting other things.
Yeah.
By showing his kindness and tenderness and in that he's kind of condescending in the positive way, like he's relatable and all these
things.
But in saying those things, you're accidentally failing to say other things. Or in the new Exodus movie, they portray God as a snarky 10-year-old.
Right? Yeah.
Now, so many problems with the way they portrayed God. But the problem is whenever you try to portray and create an image of God, you have to say false things about him.
Yeah.
Or limit.
I mean, I found one of the worst ones is the Noah movie, where God was never really, like,
totally
didn't image him.
Kind of silent.
But he's just like this silent, angry environmentalist.
So I would more just, or less, like, I think I would just say, I'm not going to go the full Puritan.
Right.
I would just say, tread carefully. Tread very carefully when you portray God.
Yeah.
Because you'll never get it fully right.
And I think
it's risky.
And the other side of it is allow the cross to motivate your worship,
but not
based on what it does, not be the object.
So I would say,
your affection.
I would say, I'm really, really cautious and uncomfortable with the amount of images, statues, pictures that are used in the typical Catholic Church.
Right.
And maybe the image isn't wrong in and of itself, but I definitely the way I've seen people worship the image, worship the statue.
So are you for or against the Jesus action figure?
Is it an active one? I think it's different with worship.
Yeah, no, that's true.
I'd probably be against
it. Yeah, I'm not...
The Jesus bobblehead.
Tread
carefully,
yeah,
my friend.
Yeah. Let's not take the Lord our God lightly, as I think... Personally, I'm uncomfortable with even the, like, Jesus is my homeboy, like, language. Like, on one hand, it says... You're right. It says something true in a colloquialism about who Jesus is. Like, he is friend of sinners. He is gracious, compassionate, loving. He wants to be close. But he's also Yahweh. We need to tread carefully.
I think the idea, and what the Puritans were getting at, is God has already revealed himself to us, and that should be the basis of our worship.
Right.
Namely, in his word. The problem is, and I think this is the heart of what they're getting at, is we take what he has already revealed and shown us who he is in his word.
Right.
When we move that to the side and say, no, I want to... picture. I want a different picture. I want a different image. In order to worship God, I want to worship him with a painting.
Yeah.
Do you see how problematic this is? To take his self-revelation, move it to the side, and our worship is centered around something else.
Something we've created.
Yeah.
And no matter how we say about him.
No matter how it is based on the word, that's problematic.
It makes a lot of sense. And
potentially idolatrous. So that was their nervousness around it, and I think it was somewhat well-founded.
No, that's helpful. Speaking of treading carefully, another question that came in built around actually that aspect, not treading carefully, is I found maybe not a question so much as a protest or a wanting clarification, and maybe you can add to it. I don't know that there's much to say beyond what the text has said, but the story in Exodus... Numbers chapter 20, Moses drawing water from the rock. And he does so in a way that actually leads to his exclusion from entering the promised land with the Israelites. And so I've heard a number of people actually in the last little while say to me, that seems unfair that Moses has led these people for, 40 plus years, wandering through the desert, and then one kind of
slip up,
for lack of a better term, causes him to be excluded from entering the promised land. And essentially, what the text says is God gives him instructions, him and Aaron, the people.
It's funny, read it.
Yeah, the people are quarreled with Moses and said, "This is Exodus chapter 20. Would that we perish when our brothers perish before the Lord. Why have you brought the assembly of the Lord into the wilderness that we should die here, both us and our cattle? And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? There's no place for grains or figs, and there's no water to drink." Then Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the entrance of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. And the glory of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the staff and assemble the congregation, you and Aaron your brother, and tell the rock before their eyes to yield its water. So you shall bring water out of the rock for them and give drink to the congregation and their cattle." And Moses took the staff from before the Lord, and as he commanded him. Then Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, shall we bring water for you out of this rock?" And Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock with his staff twice, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank and had livestock. And the Lord said to Moses, "Because you did not believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given you. These are the waters of Meribah, where the people of Israel quarreled with the Lord, and through them he showed himself holy." So we have this account where essentially God gives Moses some instructions. People are upset, gives him some instructions, says, "Hey, God, we'd like some water." God says, "Here's how you're going to get water. I want you to speak to the rock, and it'll bring forth water."
Yeah.
And Moses, it sounds to me very much like in his frustration, "Hear now, you rebels," is kind of how he addresses the people.
Yeah.
And he strikes the rock twice, and that action, or the words, or something in how he did it, upset and angered the Lord enough that it precipitated his exclusion into bringing the people into the land. So why do you think that is? What did he do that was so kind of egregious that if God could show grace in so many ways for so many things that the people of Israel did wandering in the desert and allow them to enter the land or their children, I guess. But it's not like they were, the children were probably not blameless either.
Yeah.
This failing the covenant promises of God precipitated generation to generation. But that Moses, who had been a pretty faithful and obedient and saw God face to face, didn't get this gift.
It's a story that leaves us with some questions that are unanswered in the text. I think the important thing to say is, it feels like Moses didn't get to go in because he hit the rock. Well, what the text actually says is something a little bit bigger.
Right.
And it, so you read Numbers 20. Yeah. It says, you did not believe in me. You know, why doesn't he get to go in? The Lord said, because you did not believe in me. I think that's the one thing, and related to it, to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel. And, okay, and then in Deuteronomy 32, kind of, it summarizes it.
Yeah, he's dying. Or
at the end of his life.
Dies, yeah.
Verse 51, Deuteronomy 32, because you broke faith with me in the midst of the people of Israel at the waters of Meribah Kadesh, in the wilderness of Zin, and because you did not treat me as holy in the midst of the people of Israel, for you shall not see the land. So, in both those cases, what it says is it was a breaking of faith or an unbelief.
Right.
And it was, God was not held up as holy. I think there's something about it that is very public. Everyone gathers around.
Right.
And Moses doesn't, not only disobeys or doesn't quite obey, he acts in such a way that it shows unbelief and it shows
a disregard for God's
holiness. So God was not held up as holy in the presence of all the people. Whether it was the unbelief, what's the unbelief? Whether it was that, you know, the first time Moses strikes the rock back in Exodus.
Yeah.
And so maybe Moses did not believe that speaking to the rock would work, so he strikes it twice. And God provides in spite of his disobedience and disbelief. Or was it something else, that he was unbelief? And then that held up as holy is, with everyone watching, Moses disregards the instructions of God and does it his own way. We don't know tone. We don't know language. We see that word, you rebels.
Yeah.
So, which kind of gives me the impression that he's angry and he's striking the rock instead of speaking to it.
Yeah.
It feels like an angry outburst when he's supposed to be acting and obeying God, and that this diminishes God's holiness in the eyes of the people. And because he's the leader, he's Moses, he's the model, it has to be dealt with.
Yeah, and I mean, that's, to me, that's the part that I find the rationale that God gives, or the reasoning that God gives, but to me, I always come back to that statement. And I haven't looked at it in the original languages, but because I don't know how. So just English is all I got. You might have more. but this idea, here now you rebels. So there's a bit of like, sounds like condescension. Yeah. I don't know what the right word is. You can figure it out. Shall we bring water from for you out of this rock?
We.
To me, that was like, the question I asked when I first read that is he talking about him and Aaron? Is he talking about him and God?
I think he's talking about him and Aaron.
And so, is that actually the egregious sin where he's, him and Aaron are kind of going, all right, people.
Fine.
Like, we're taking on the role of God in this. Who knows? But it's,
as opposed to, so what maybe we're speculating, but what could or should he have said is, hear, O people, the Lord your God providing for you.
Yes.
Bring forth water from the rock, and the water comes out. Yeah. And God is held up as holy. Instead, we're going to do it. Smack, smack, water.
Yeah.
Angrily.
Kind of like, pumps. Stop whining, here's your water, as opposed to the Lord has provided for your needs.
I think what we learn from it, what we see from it, is something that the Bible itself and the biblical authors really holds up as valuable and important, which we do not, which is the holiness of God. That God must be seen as holy. And for the biblical authors, that's really, really important to them.
Well, and I think the other side is that there is, mixed in often, there is grace mixed with consequence. Mm-hmm. So that, like, I don't think that Moses wasn't forgiven for this. by God.
Yeah, no.
But I think that the consequence of his maybe lack of regard for God's holiness and his failure in leadership eliminated him from this kind of high honor, though God was quite gracious in allowing him to see the land and like see the fruition of his work and service. But yeah.
I think it's also, there's this larger sovereignty question. What I mean is, I think God, by design, we're never presented a hero of the Bible who's flawless. Right. And I think that's on purpose. Is how quickly we are and would be to worship a man. And yet all the biblical heroes, whether it's Paul and Peter in the New Testament, whether it's David, the great king, flawed. Moses, the great prophet, flawed. Abraham, the father of the people, flawed. I think that's good, because no matter which hero we look to, we see that they also need a savior.
Which I think, which even in our context now is important to understand when we, because we all, you and I both do it too, we highly regard men of God who bring us word, and we read their books and we watch their sermons or listen to their messages, go to hear them speak, and they are as flawed as anyone else too, but they're just faithfully going through. So one of the things we're going to try and do over the next, probably we'll see how many we get to today in our time remaining, but in maybe this podcast, the next one, we'll see how long it goes. We just decided, since we've kind of wrapped up the Pentateuch is rich, it is awesome, it can be confusing, and there is a bit of weird things. And I'm sure if you've done the reading plan and you're through, and you're caught up or whatever, and you're through the first five books of the Bible, there were a few points at least in certain passages where you stopped and went, wait, what? That is, why is that there? So, Stephen, I thought it'd be fun and helpful to maybe just kind of walk through some of the obscure laws that you find and instructions, and then just kind of shed a few light on them, some light on them to give context and help us understand, are these things that are still binding, or
why?
Or why are they not? Or why are they? Why were they given? So we'll start with the first one that is quoted. I've heard quoted a few times. Is you Leviticus 19:28? You shall not make any cuts on your body for the dead, or tattoo yourselves. I am the Lord. And this is, I think, the only reference in Scripture to tattooing. And often the framework from which people use to
say it's wrong.
Say it's wrong.
So you actually have to read, I'm going to read verse 26, 27, 28, because in this section of Leviticus 19, there's groupings of laws together, and at the end of the grouping it says, I am the Lord. Right. So they're meant to be read together. So verse 26, 27, 28, 28 is the end of this kind of grouping. Yeah. So, you shall not eat any flesh with the blood in it. You shall not interpret omens or tell fortunes. You shall not round off the hair on your temples or mar the edges of your beard. You shall not make any cuts on your body for the dead or tattoo yourselves, I am the Lord. And you go, what do those things have in common? Well, what they are is all of those are practices, worship practices of the Canaanites that they're moving into the land with.
Yeah.
And they are all, these aren't meaningless random commands. These are all Canaanite idolatry practices. And really what the heart of it is, don't imitate the worship of the Canaanites, the pagan practices. So they would cut themselves and mark themselves, tattoo themselves for the dead. They would, the things with the beard and the hair, omens, fortune telling, eating the flesh with blood in it. These are all practices of the Canaanites that they were forbidden because they are different and they are special and they're God's special people. They're supposed to be different than the Canaanites and reject their pagan practices. So.
Okay.
Well, the really the applicable law for us is, to summarize it, do not practice Canaanite paganism.
Okay.
That's the kind of transcultural principle.
All right, we can. I think I can handle that.
So I think that's very different than what, you know, people tattooing themselves today. You know, they could be sinful depending on why you're doing it, motivations,
right,
what you're tattooing, those types of things. But really, what this verse is getting at, And there may be other verses that are relevant, but this verse is getting at Canaanite idolatry.
Hmm. Okay. And then there's a few ones, a few different ones in Deuteronomy 22, in kind of consecutive verses 9, 10, 11, and 12, that talks about don't mix stuff. So it says, do not, starting in verse 9, you shall not sow your vineyard with two kinds of seed. And then it says in verse 10, you shall not plow an ox and a donkey together. Verse 11 says, you shall not wear clothes of wool and linen mixed together. And then talks a bit more about clothes at the end. But those three kind of go together. And the mixed wool and linen one is often you'll hear a lot of critics go, oh, like you want to hold this passage up as being justified, then what is your, you wearing a cotton poly blend shirt, then you're just as breaking the law. So can you shed some light on those laws?
Well, I think the idea seems to be there's a series of laws about mixing things, especially mixing things that are kind of clean and like the two animals, the ox and the donkey, one's a clean animal, one's an unclean animal.
Right.
And I think the idea is about mixing, and there needs to be a distinction and order in life. And so some of these rules are there for that, to maintain distinction. Why some of the distinctions? It's not clear. The text doesn't really say. So I think, and in some ways, scholars are a little puzzled. They have guesses. But so some of the guesses are, for Israel, they needed to maintain distinctions. There's clean and unclean. There's right and wrong. And life is ordered in a certain way. And that extends as a reminder to even how they dress and how they sow their fields, that there's distinction and clarity around these types of things in God's way of life. They themselves are to be a distinct people separate from the Canaanites. They don't mix with them.
Right.
They're supposed to be distinct in the way they live, morally, that there's distinction in that there's the one God and they don't worship these other gods. There's distinction in right and wrong, and life is kind of structured and patterned after God's design. And some of these laws are there to remind them of that.
Yeah.
So that seems to be part of their, as God's unique special covenant people, they live with distinction. They look different than the other people, and these are some of the things why. So, and mixing together everything is not.
So we're okay to wear mixed fabrics.
Well, these laws are Israel's laws. They're not our laws. It's not our covenant. And they're related to Israel's unique place in the land at that time. Right. So they don't carry relevance for us, I would say.
Okay.
I'd say no.
Well, I think that's I agree.
And that's kind of why
shedding light. Not everything
why that he would
yeah,
say.
Not everything is a command for us. In post cross. Yeah.
New covenant.
I was gonna say post Jesus, but I'm like, we're not post Jesus. There's no post Jesus. I had to catch myself, and then I had to say it anyway. All right. Well, we got a couple more. We'll get to another time. We are out of time for today. But if you have questions, please do send them bside@thchurch.ca. Steve and I would love to dig into them and try to provide any clarity we can. We make no promises, but we often do our best. And most of us know that Steve does a really good job of digging into the text and finding us answers. So please do send those in. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time.
Have a good week.